This podcast does not contain legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. The podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC volunteers are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. This podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer.
Hello everyone, my name is Mahek.
And my name is Eniayo.
On today's episode of Pro Bono Radio, we will be talking about white-collar crime and Ponzi schemes. First, we'll explain what white-collar crime is and why it challenges common assumptions about criminality. Then we'll break down how Ponzi schemes operate. From there, we'll examine R.V. Johnson, an Alberta case that shows the real human impact of this type of fraud. Finally, we'll consider what this case tells us about sentencing, deterrence, and broader social implications. When you hear the word crime, who do you picture? What comes to mind? For many people, crime is associated with violence, street crime, or someone from a lower socioeconomic background. We often imagine crime as something loud, visible, and immediately threatening, something that happens quickly and leaves obvious damage behind. But that picture of crime leaves out an entire category of wrongdoing that operates very differently. These are crimes that don't rely on force, weapons, or physical intimidation. Instead, they unfold quietly, often over long periods of time, and their effects aren't always immediately visible, and yet the harm they cause can be just as serious, if not more.
Exactly. White-collar crimes often take place in everyday settings. Offices, boardrooms, places of worship, and trusted community spaces. They are committed by people who appear respectable, credible, and trustworthy. People who don't fit our usual idea of what a criminal looks like. Because of that, these crimes are so easy to overlook, and for a long time, they weren't even treated with the same seriousness as other offenses. The damage they cause is often financial rather than physical, and that can make it harder to recognize just how deeply they affect people's lives.
Today, we're talking about white-collar crime, and more specifically, Ponzi schemes, a form of fraud that relies not on force, but on trust. These schemes exploit personal relationships, community ties, and assumptions about credibility, allowing them to spread quietly until it's too late. By looking at how these crimes work and at a real Canadian case that illustrates their impact, we can better understand why white-collar crimes deserve serious attention and why it matters beyond the money involved.
White-collar crime challenges many of our assumptions about who commits crime and who becomes a victim. Unlike traditional stereotypes, white-collar offenders are often seen as respectable, educated, and deeply embedded in their communities. They may hold professional positions, leadership roles, or social status that shields them from suspicion. Research has consistently shown that crime is not limited to people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. White-collar crime highlights how financial and social power can be misused in ways that are difficult to detect and easy to rationalize. Because these crimes often involve complex transactions, paperwork, or professional jargon, they can appear legitimate on the surface, even when harm is occurring underneath. For many years, white-collar crimes were not even viewed as truly criminal. Financial misconduct was often framed as a business issue or civil dispute, rather than a matter for the criminal justice system. Business people were largely free to conduct their affairs as they wished, and this lack of scrutiny allowed serious wrongdoing to go unchecked.
The historical reluctance to treat white-collar crime as real crime shaped how society responded to it. Enforcement was limited, penalties were often mild, and victims were frequently left without meaningful recognition or support. As a result, white-collar crime developed a reputation as less harmful or less deserving of punishment than other offenses. Understanding this context is important because it helps explain why these crimes can persist for long periods of time and why public attitudes towards them have been slow to change. One of the most common and well-known examples of white-collar crime, one that captures many of these issues, is the Ponzi scheme.
A Ponzi scheme is an investment scam where early investors are paid by using money taken from later investors. There are no real profits. Instead, the scheme survives by creating the illusion of success. As long as new investors keep joining, the scheme appears to work. People receive returns, confidence grows, and skepticism fades. But once new investments slow down, the entire structure collapses. These schemes rely heavily on word of mouth, social proof, and personal trust. Victims often invest not because they fully understand the investment, but because they trust the person offering it. The harm can be devastating, especially when people invest their life savings or retirement funds. With that framework in mind, we can turn to a Canadian case that shows just how damaging Ponzi schemes can be in practice.
Today, we're focusing on R.V. Johnson, a case decided by the Alberta Court of Queen's Bench in 2010. This case illustrates how Ponzi schemes can exploit personal relationships and target vulnerable individuals within close-knit communities.
The events in this case took place in and around Lethbridge, Alberta. Jerry Johnson was found guilty of fraud under Section 381A of the Criminal Code. Between October 2004 and April 2006, Johnson used deceit, falsehood, and other fraudulent means to defraud more than 50 individuals and a company. In total, approximately $2.43 million was taken. This was described as a Ponzi scheme. Many of the victims were not sophisticated investors, and for several of them, this was their very first investment. Johnson convinced investors that their money was being placed into legitimate ventures, including businesses, the stock market, commodities, mutual funds, and even the World Bank.
What makes this case particularly troubling is who the victims were and how Johnson gained their trust. About half of the victims were members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, where Johnson served as an assistant pastor. He used his position within the church to persuade people to invest, presenting himself not just as a financial advisor, but as a trusted community and religious leader.
Johnson's role in the community played a crucial part in the effectiveness of the scheme. Beyond his position in the church, he also hosted a local television show centered on investing. To an ordinary person, Johnson appeared credible, knowledgeable, and trustworthy. His authority and visibility helped him bypass the skepticism that would normally arise when someone is asked to hand over their money. This reflects a broader pattern in the white-collar crimes. These crimes often succeed not through anonymity, but through familiarity. The closer the relationship, the harder it becomes for victims to question what is happening.
The key issue before the court was determining an appropriate sentence given the scale of fraud and the harm caused. In sentencing Johnson, the court emphasized the gravity of the offense and Johnson's high degree of responsibility. The judge considered the number of victims, the significant financial losses, and the deeply personal impact on individuals who trusted Johnson, not only as an advisor, but as a spiritual leader. Importantly, the court noted that this case involved harm to individuals rather than corporations, which heightened the seriousness of the offense.
Ultimately, the court imposed a 13-year custodial sentence and ordered Johnson to pay $913,000 in restitution. The judge stated that taking into account the nature of the offense, the nature of the offender, the impact on the victims, and the principle of proportionality, the sentence was fit and proper.
This case highlights that financial loss is only part of the harm caused by Ponzi schemes. Many victims experience long-term consequences like loss of retirement security, strain on family relationships, shame, anxiety, and a lasting loss of trust in institutions and communities. Unlike corporate victims, individuals often don't have insurance, legal teams, or financial buffers. For some, this loss permanently alters their quality of life. That context helps explain why the court placed such an emphasis on victim impact during sentencing.
There is a common belief that white-collar criminals get off easy. R.V. Johnson complicates that narrative. A 13-year sentence is significant, especially when compared to sentences for some other violent offenses. This reflects a shift in judicial thinking, recognizing that large-scale fraud can cause widespread, lasting harm. But unfortunately, given that the sentence dropped by 3 years on appeal, and that Johnson seems to have gotten out of jail 2 years after he was sentenced, and knowing that he probably served his sentence in minimum security, the idea that white-collar criminals are still able to travel relatively gently through the criminal justice system may still be said to be alive and well. However, Canadian attitudes towards white-collar crimes have evolved, with legislative changes, including mandatory minimum sentences for large-scale fraud. White-collar crime is increasingly viewed as a serious and unacceptable criminal behavior.
That raises an important question. Does harsh sentencing actually deter white-collar crime? Some argue that white-collar offenders don't expect to be caught, limiting the deterrent effect. Others believe that strong sentences send an important message, particularly in cases involving community trust and vulnerable victims. Even if deterrence is imperfect, sentencing still plays a symbolic role. It affirms that these crimes are serious and deserving of a meaningful punishment.
Beyond the individual victims, cases like R.V. Johnson raise broader questions about how society understands harm and responsibility. White-collar crime often sits uncomfortably within our traditional ideas of criminality because it lacks visible violence, even though its effects can be deeply destabilizing.
One important implication is how these crimes affect confidence in social institutions. When fraud occurs through organizations or roles that are meant to provide guidance, stability, or protection, it can weaken public trust not just in individuals but in the institutions themselves. That loss of confidence can extend well beyond the immediate community affected.
White-collar crime also exposes structural vulnerabilities. These schemes thrive in environments where credibility replaces oversight and where people assume that shared values or professional status reduces risks of wrongdoing. That assumption creates gaps that can be exploited, allowing misconduct to continue undetected for long periods of time.
From a broader perspective, this challenges the way we think about prevention. It suggests that addressing white-collar crime requires more than punishment after the fact. It raises questions about regulation, transparency, and the systems we rely on to assess credibility and trust.
Understanding these wider implications help explain why white-collar crime is increasingly viewed as a serious social issue rather than a private financial dispute. The harm extends beyond individual losses, affecting how communities function and how institutions maintain legitimacy.
As we close today's episode on Ponzi schemes and white-collar crime, I want to leave you with a line from Woody Guthrie's Pretty Boy Floyd. This song tells the story of a 1930s bank robber who became a folk legend during the Great Depression. He was criminalized by the state, but sometimes romanticized by the public. It's a song about an outlaw from the Depression era, but one lyric feels especially relevant to what we've been discussing. Some will rob you with a six gun, and some with a fountain pen. White-collar crime rarely looks dramatic. There is no chase scene, no flashing lights, but the damage can be just as devastating. As you listen to this song, think about who we call criminals, who we romanticize, and how harm actually shows up in people's lives.
You say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Well, here's a Christmas dinner for the family's own relief. Well, it's through this world of ramble I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun, and some with a fountain pen. But it's through this world you ramble, it's through this world you roam. You won't never see an outlaw drive a family from their home. White-collar
crime may look different from traditional crime, but its consequences can just be as devastating, financially, emotionally, and socially. Cases like R.V. Johnson remind us that trust can be exploited and that the criminal law plays a critical role in responding to these abuses. Thanks for listening to this episode of Pro Bono Radio. We hope that this discussion helped shed light on the real impact of white-collar crime and why these cases matter.
Disclaimer. This podcast does not contain legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC volunteers are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. This podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer.